mornings. I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, the program director of the new acute rehabilitation unit at Blanchard Valley Hospital explains what it means for patient recovery. Also this morning, what unexpected turn will the 2024 presidential election take next? Does Joe Biden's decision to drop out of the race create more questions than it answers for Democrats? And happening around town, there's another big celebration this weekend at the Black Heritage Library and Multicultural Center. We'll get a preview of their Haitian Caribbean Summer Festival. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Tuesday, July 23rd, 2024. There was a conversation immediately in the aftermath of President Biden's decision not to seek a second term on Sunday, or a conversation saying, what does this mean for the Democrats' national convention coming up next month? Is this just going to be a complete free-for-all? Is it going to be a brokered convention? Is it going to be, you know, just a complete mess? And apparently it's all settled now. It didn't take very long. I think we mentioned yesterday there was a report that they believed that Kamala Harris would have the nomination locked up by Wednesday, and it didn't even take that long before she had everything all set. And so lay that to rest, apparently. I don't know. I'm just wondering what else is going to happen next in this crazy 2024 election cycle. And by the way, it appears that the Simpsons has struck again. Some users on social media have pointed out an episode entitled Bart to the Future that aired back in the year 2000 features Lisa Simpson becoming the first female president of the United States wearing a purple suit and pearls, and the outfit looks eerily like the ensemble that Kamala Harris wore during the 2021 inauguration. The episode also mentions President Trump years before the then reality TV star became president. Simpsons writer Al Jean, how does he pronounce that? I don't know. He responded to fan reactions on X, formerly Twitter. I am proud to be a part of all of it. So that's so The Simpsons has, for years, people have combed through old episodes of The Simpsons to find eerily on-point predictions of future events, and now it appears that they have struck again. I don't know. I thought it was kind of interesting. I did see a survey. It was a YouGov survey, 1,100 U.S. adults, and they asked, do you think America is ready to elect a woman as president? And 51% said yes. 51%, which is a majority, but it's interesting that 49% were not necessarily ready to issue an unqualified yes. 22% said that they weren't sure. 27% said no, flat out no, we're not ready to elect a woman president. I don't know why we wouldn't be ready to elect a woman president, but I guess at least if that poll is to be believed, Kamala Harris can do absolutely nothing to get 27% of the vote. So Donald Trump has 27% of the vote right there. I just think that's rather interesting that it was only 51%. It is a majority, but I would have expected it to be a little bit higher than that. But we'll see what now whether Americans are ready to elect this particular woman president is another question entirely. But any woman president, I think we're to the point where we could do that without any qualms or reservations. Let's see what else is going on among the first thing. We're going to talk more about that. All of this as we get a little bit deeper into the program here. This crazy election cycle with all of its twists and turns. Some of the other most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Tuesday morning started here. How many hours do you work in a week? People write on their time cards or, turn into their employer, but do you work more hours than you actually report? I think many of us would say, if we were being honest, we probably do a little extra work here and there that we don't put on our time card. Maybe you don't. I don't know. But I think most of us probably put in some time that we aren't formally compensated for. According to the latest data, Mexico tops the list of the number of hours that people work annually. The average worker in Mexico puts in 2,207 hours of work every year. Mexico topping the list. Costa Rica comes in second place with 2,171 hours worked per year. Chile is third with 1,343 hours. They ranked 34 nations in all. The United States came in ninth place with 1,799 hours. Now, wait a minute. I know what you're thinking, and I'm thinking the same thing. How is it that Chile is third with 1,343 hours and the U.S. comes in ninth with 1,799 hours? Is there a typo here someplace? I don't know. I'll have to look it up. I'm just going off of the story in the Newswire here. The USA is the only advanced economy, it says on the list, that has no guaranteed paid vacation time. It's left up to the employer. Employees in the European Union are entitled to at least 4 weeks of paid vacation time every year. It's the law. 4 weeks. That's a month off. Kind of interesting. I don't know how many people have that much time. If you do, more power to you. I just think that's interesting. The U.S. is ninth place in the number of hours worked per year, 1,799. Okay. All right, moving on. Some of the other, I'll look that up because that does seem to be a typo on that. But anyway, let's see what else is going on. Oh, this is maybe good news for the state of Ohio. Cincinnati is in the running to host the Sundance Film Festival moving forward. The Sundance Institute announced independent film festivals, and it's been held in Utah, in Park City, Utah, for many, many years. And they are looking at maybe changing up the location beginning in 2027. The Sundance Institute announced the finalist cities that include a chance to return to Park City and the Salt Lake region, but also on the list, Atlanta, Boulder, Colorado, Louisville, Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Cincinnati, Ohio is on the finalist among the list. The Institute took into account the infrastructure and event capabilities of every city chosen. For now, the Sundance Film Festival will remain in Park City for 2025 and 2026. But then beyond that, they're looking at maybe moving it. They might still stay in Park City, but they are at least exploring other options. So in Cincinnati appears to be one of the options there. Kind of interesting. This is going to cause some debate. Rolling Stone is out with their list of the 100 best album covers of all time. The 100 best album covers of all time. Among them, Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, I think was in fourth place overall. Second place was the Beatles' Abbey Road. And the first place best album cover of all time, an album called Unknown Pleasures by Joy Division, which features a black and white image of a pulsar. Number one album cover of all time. Led Zeppelin 4 is not on there. I'm a bit surprised by that. Not in the top five. Dark Side of the Moon is a great album cover. It's not particularly complex, but then again, doesn't necessarily happen. You know, Nirvana's album cover with the little baby has to be on the list, doesn't it? But anyway, so if you're an aficionado, a music aficionado, best album covers of all time, the list is out on Rolling Stone, best album covers of all time. Music fans everywhere are going to be debating this. And one other item among the first things you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. This also will cause quite a bit of debate. In-N-Out Burger is no longer considered the best fast food burger in America. USA Today is out with their latest 10 best list of the best fast food burgers in the country. And their number one choice is now the Habit Burger Grill, which is a California-based chain. So another California-based chain. In-N-Out is too. But the Habit Burger Grill, made with two patties, caramelized onions, and other toppings, number one in the country. In-N-Out, the double-double, came in second place in the nation. If you've ever been out west and you had an In-N-Out burger, it is very good. It is only number two on the list. BurgerFi, and their barbecue rodeo burger, is number three. Jack in the Box Jumbo Jack cheeseburger is number four. And you have to go all the way down to number five before you get to a burger that we, you know, really have in this area. There are a few handful of Jack in the Box restaurants in our area, in a region, but none here locally. Five Guys cheeseburger is number five. I guess it would be Five Guys. It should be at number five, I guess. But that is number five on the list. Let's see here. Culver's Butter Burger, Double Butter Burger with Cheese at number seven. Burger King's Whopper is at number eight. Really? That kind of surprised me. And the Double Western Bacon Cheeseburger from Carl's Jr., which we have around here by the name of Hardee's. It's basically the same chain with a different name, Carl's Jr. out west and Hardee's in the east. The Double Western Bacon Cheeseburger is number nine, and the 1921 Slider from White Castle at number 10. So there's the best fast food burgers in America. Your mileage may vary, but some of the things that people be talking about, for sure. These are the things that, you know, people debate on social media and all of that. So there you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Tuesday morning started here.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Partly to mostly sunny skies today with the high in the mid-80s. Partly cloudy tonight, low in the upper 60s. The Findlay City Council is deciding whether to enact a moratorium on the establishment of recreational marijuana dispensaries in the city. Findlay Mayor Christina Mern was on with WFIN's Chris Oakes to discuss the issue.
I think it is a really complex topic that we don't have all the answers on yet. And so that's why we've brought forward the moratorium, to kind of push pause to make sure that we get clearer guidance from the state and execute this really well for our community.
The ordinance requires three readings before City Council, and the third reading will happen at the August 6th meeting. Get more of the mayor's interview with Chris in the story on our website. The Highway Patrol says a semi-truck driver has been indicted on 26 charges in a crash that killed six people, including some high school students, in November. The crash happened on Interstate 70 in Licking County. A grand jury indicted Jacob McDonald of Zanesville on 26 charges, and he appeared before a Licking County judge, and his bond was set at $1 million. Get more in this story on our website. The City of Findlay has issued a road construction update for this week. Among the projects, South Blanchard Street will be closed to through traffic from 6th Street to Hobart Avenue for waterline replacement, and Crystal Avenue will be closed to through traffic from North Main Street to the railroad for curb replacement. Get a full list of the projects and the story on our website. Businesses are invited to attend the Ignite 419 event in Fostoria. The Fostoria Economic Development Corporation says the newly established Ignite 419 event offers Northwest Ohio area businesses a full day of informative and engaging workshops and panel discussions on today's essential business topics led by respected subject matter experts from the region. Ignite 419 is coming up in October. Get more details on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
So our cover story this morning, want to talk about the new acute rehabilitation unit at Blanchard Valley Hospital. Big announcement, BVH. On the opening of this, we are joined by Beth Courtwright and Jessica Moore and from Blanchard Valley Health System, the acute rehabilitation unit. So, first of all, let's talk a little bit about what this is. What is an acute rehabilitation unit?
So, an acute rehabilitation unit takes patients that have things like strokes, head injuries, spinal cord injuries, and provides medical care. The doctor has to see them at least 3 days a week, so a little bit more intense medical care than a skilled nursing facility, and they receive very intensive therapy, 3 hours a day.
Wow. So so this clearly is for those individuals who have had an event like you described but are not ready to be released to their homes or, as you said, even to like another rehab facility.
Correct.
So is this located within the hospital?
Yes, okay. Right within the hospital.
So kind of take us through what happens when someone is admitted to this unit then.
So first of all, they have an acute event, obviously a stroke or something like that, and the hospital makes a referral to our unit. So they have to meet criteria. They have to be able to do 3 hours of therapy a day. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be in a row. You know, we can break that up into different times. They can have naps, you know, whatever the rest periods are that they need. So it's not like they're in the gym for 3 hours straight. Mm-hmm. And then they have to meet medical criteria, too. So they have to have that medical oversight by a physician. They have to have 24-hour nursing care, those types of things. So when the doctor approves them to come in, when they meet that criteria, they come into our unit. They're assessed by the nurse. They're assessed by therapy, PT, OT, and potentially speech therapy. And then they are there for about 10 to 14 days on average. So they're getting that really intense therapy and medical care.
Okay, so that was going to be the other question that I had, is what kind of time frame we're looking at. So basically a couple of weeks of intensive therapy. This is not something that people are going to be in there for, you know, weeks or months at a time.
Correct. Right.
It's kind of interesting. I'm looking at the photos that the hospital shared with the of this unit, and we have it on our webpage. It looks like, well, almost an apartment-like kind of situation. I mean, this is more than just a standard hospital room.
Correct.
Yeah. So the goal is to for the patients to go home. So the therapy that they receive encourages that. So the actual patient room is similar to any other hospital room, but on the nursing unit, there's of course a very large therapy gym. There's also a dining room, so we encourage all of the patients to eat together. That way, socializing is part of therapy and is part of recovery when you're trying to adapt to some type of change in function. So we have a very nice a dining room for that. That's also where we have activities. So, you know, during the weekend when there may not be as much therapy, then nursing takes over and provides a lot of that therapy and socialization and activities for the patients during that time frame. And then we also have an ADL suite is what we call. ADL stands for Activities of Daily Living. So in that room, that's where it looks more of that apartment style. So we have the kitchen. We have a bed that doesn't doesn't have side rails like a typical hospital bed, so you can practice getting in and out of the bed without that resource. We have a washer and a dryer, a stove that's hooked up, an actual tub in the bathroom so you can practice stepping into it. And so the goal is for the patient to practice the skills that they would be utilizing at home. So practice cooking meals, practice doing laundry, putting things in and out of the fridge. So that room is really used as an extension for therapy. And one other thing that I'm a nurse by background, so this is know about therapy, but acute rehab is definitely even more than what I typically experienced in my background. And really, therapy is what the patient does all day. Yeah. And so even their shower in the morning is incorporated if therapy is there, assessing and evaluating as part of their therapy hours, and really trying to promote that independence. Of course, we want to honor whatever the patient wishes, but our goal really is to try to get the patients home.
So, it makes sense. I mean, when you're talking about an acute event like this, I mean, a lot of those everyday things that we sort of take for granted have to be relearned to some extent or another, hence all of the, resources there, I guess, for lack of a better term, to help do that and evaluate the progress on this. Why in the hospital? I mean, what is the advantage of having this actually in the hospital itself as opposed to in another facility or at another place?
I think the benefit is one that's really easy on the patient as well as the family. So instead of having to travel across town and adapt to a new environment, they can just move down to the next unit. Yeah. But even more than that, all of the resources at the hospital are available to the patient, and these patients may be more medically complex. So if the patient has cardiology following them, or neurology, nephrology, whatever those specialties might be, surgery, and they're not ready to fully be off the case, but they are ready for rehab, they can stay on the case and they can still see the patient. And so that's a win-win. We have lab in the building, radiology in the building, all of those needs that the patient might have, it's still all in the building while the patient can get that rehab.
So is the goal then to go from the acute rehab unit, return back home, or then go to I guess, for lack of a better term, a step-down facility to assisted living or, some other sort of nursing care, at least temporarily? Or
our goal would always be to have our patients go home, but sometimes that's not possible. Mm-hmm. And home is long-term care because that resident will live at long-term care. Home can be assisted living, but we would like them to go home. But sometimes people do need more therapy and they go to, like, a skilled facility, a nursing home, to get a little more.
And I would imagine this, especially for someone who, who has a stroke or some such event that comes on suddenly, this also provides some sort of guidance as to what that next step will look like, whether it is back to home or a nursing facility or whatever.
Right. We start discharge planning as soon as the patient walks through our door. Hmm. So we want to know what their goals are, what their family's goals are. And then we try to incorporate the family into education. We have a team meeting every week with nursing, all the therapies, the physician, our case manager, to know that what their goal is, what we're working towards, and how they're going to get there. And then if there's barriers to that, we try to work through that.
So it can be very helpful for the family in that respect as well. How many patients can you serve at a time in this unit?
So we have a 12-bed unit, and we have consistently been having about five to six patients, but we are prepared to take more patients. So
a comfortable number there. This also strikes me as another example of the way healthcare, especially in the 21st century, is more than just about the family physician and the hospital. I mean, this is highly specialized and targeted care.
Right. You know, like I said, intense therapy, 3 hours a day, nursing care, 24 hours a day. The physician is having oversight over that. And it's so nice because this is the first in Hancock County, and patients used to have to go to Lima or Toledo for this care.
That's what I was going to say. Absent this acute rehabilitation unit, which is new, what was the process before?
So oftentimes, patients would go to skilled nursing because it was more convenient than traveling over an hour from Hancock County to receive that level of care. If patients were very critical, they would be referred to one of those other acute rehab locations, and they would go, but that was quite a burden on the patient and the family.
Yeah.
And like I said, there were quite a bit of patients that probably would have benefited, but it just wasn't reasonable for them to travel that distance for therapy.
So having to make that some really hard choices in those situations. So this is open now. Coming up, I believe it is later this week. Is it on Thursday? There's another webinar event where you'll be able to share more information about this if folks are interested. Is that right?
Right. On Thursday.
Yes, Thursday afternoon on Facebook. There is a Facebook Live with Beth and I and Dr. Coase just to do more Q&A about acute rehab and provide that education on the service.
Very good. We have a link up for more information about it on our webpage. And again, if you want to learn more about the acute rehabilitation unit at Blanchard Valley Hospital, check out that webinar on Thursday. And what's the time for that?
I think it's at 12:30.
At 12:30, okay. But again, that's linked up. I don't mean to put you on the spot. It's linked up on our webpage. You can go to goodmornings.net and learn more about that. Beth Courtwright, Jessica Moore with us this morning. Thanks very much for dropping by. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So what unexpected turn will the 2024 presidential election take next? Gotta wonder, after everything that's happened over the past couple of days, what could possibly happen next? Joining us once again is Alan Sanders, former Time Magazine senior reporter, professor emeritus of political science at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey. Professor Sanders, I tell you what, we had you so many times on the program talking about these crazy twists and turns that things have taken in this election so far. We're going to have to give you co-hosting credit if we keep doing this.
Yes, indeed. I think we've all experienced a bit of political whiplash these past few days and weeks, and that's the way it goes sometimes.
Literally 48 hours ago, the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party was Joe Biden for a second term, and now already Kamala Harris is the presumptive nominee, having apparently, from what we're hearing as of this morning, wrapped up enough commitments from delegates to replace Joe Biden on the ticket. What do you make of how quickly she was able to lock this up?
Well, I think this has surprised Democrats and certainly Republicans as well. But it surprised Democrats because a lot of people were saying that the reason to stick with Joe Biden was that there would be chaos in the Democratic Party among the various factions to select a new candidate. Mm-hmm. And so many people said, well, you got to stick with Joe Biden no matter what, because the chaos would be even worse than Biden. But it hasn't turned out that way. She actually has locked down what appears to be all the votes she needs for the nomination. The leaders, the unions, the financiers of campaigns have all come behind her. And she's gotten really quite an amazing start. She will go to Wisconsin, I believe, today to basically start campaigning for herself, even though she hasn't quite gotten the nomination yet, but nonetheless, everybody expects her to.
Right.
So it's been a surprise for everybody.
But at the same time, it has also, it seems to have given Republicans some ammunition. They are hammering the Democrats for how quickly they were able to, you know, shift gears and take this exit, and saying that the timing on this, waiting so late for Biden to drop out, and how quickly he was replaced, didn't give everybody the opportunity to weigh in and have this open. You know, I understand that a lot of that is politics, but I wonder, yes, it does seem to be an orderly transition for one party, but does it also give Republicans ammunition to hammer them with on their side?
Oh, I'm sure it will, but, you know, Democrats will say, well, Republicans don't choose the Democratic nominee. Democrats do it.
So fair enough.
It's the way Democrats want to do it. That's the way they choose it. But I think more seriously than those sorts of accusations are the fact that she does carry the Biden administration, you know, problems that have plagued Biden, issues on immigration, issues on the economy. She will be hammered for have been part of the administration that has pursued policies that many Americans don't like. So that will be really the serious attacks that go against her. She, on the other hand, will say, well, now, you know, the age and cognitive issues that plagued Biden, now that shifts over to Donald Trump. And she'll point out, what the program of 2025 is, and that the Republicans seem to support that, or at least have supported it. And so it's going to be a very vigorous and brutal campaign. It's going to be close. Get ready for all kinds of ups and downs. You know, we used to say that a month in politics is a lifetime. Well, now we've got 3 months until the election, or more. So get ready for a roller coaster ride.
And certainly to this point, it is even 48 hours seems to be a lifetime in politics, the way it's been going. It does present sort of a unique situation. I mean, everything seems to be unique about this situation, including, and this struck me the other day, that we now have an experienced presidential candidate running on the outside party ticket, and the outsider, the one that we know less about, as the incumbent party. I mean, it's just kind of weird that we have a president that's not in office that's running, and the incumbent party is running someone new.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an inversion, as you point out. I mean, the incumbent, which is, of course, Kamala Harris, is less well-known than the challenger, Donald Trump. And that's something that's very important to point out, because one of the keys to winning an election is defining yourself. So what you want to be able to do as a candidate is do it yourself, define yourself in the way that you think will be successful.
Mm-hmm.
But the opposition is going to try to define you too. And whoever wins the definition contest, whether it's yourself or your opponent defining you negatively, has a huge impact on who can win the election. So get ready to see what Kamala Harris does to assert herself, to define herself, and also watch carefully what the Trump campaign does to define her in an opposite way.
And certainly already it appears that, as you were alluding to earlier, the Republicans are using the border issue to at least do that initially, really hammering Kamala Harris for her involvement in the administration's policy on the U.S. southern border. I know they've been using the term border czar, which is never one of her official titles. However, President Biden did give her a very large role in crafting that border policy, and that has consistently been among one of the top issues for many voters, issues of discontent for many voters.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's one of the strong arguments that the Republicans will make against her. They've started doing it, as you've pointed out, and they will keep doing it. On the other hand, you know, Kamala Harris is going to use abortion, an issue that has worked very well for Democrats across the country. So it's going to be that kind of a campaign, highlighting the problems that each candidate has, and, you know, making the case to the American people. I mean, both parties, their top candidates, now carry some heavy baggage. Trump has criminal issues. He's a convicted felon. He's got some problems about, you know, asserting that he would be a dictator on the first day.
Right.
Kamala Harris has immigration, crime, and most importantly, the economy. Many people still feel the problem of inflation at the kitchen table, and so that's a big issue that she has to address as well.
It also strikes me that because of the way all of this happened, that the fact that we now have a woman at the top of a major party ticket for the very first time in American history is being somewhat overshadowed because of everything that led to this.
Well, it's actually the second time. Remember, we did have Hillary Clinton, but what's striking about this is that she is a woman. She's also a woman from minority background, you know, African American and South Asian. And that raises the question in many people's minds as to whether, you know, any lurking racism among various coalitions and groups of voters will have an impact on this race. We don't know that. There was a lot of talk about Barack Obama. You know, a lot of people were supported Barack Obama, crossed their fingers, hoping that race would not tilt the election negatively against Obama. It didn't do it, at least not in a significant way. So a lot of people will also be crossing their fingers here about Kamala Harris, those who support her, about the possibilities of racism influencing the campaign. We'll have to see. We don't know that yet. We'll have to see how it plays out.
Yeah, I should clarify what I meant to say is, a minority woman being at the top of the ticket for the first time ever. It is certainly historic, but seems to maybe be overshadowed, at least in the early going, as to how significant that is. And I'm also curious, when the dust settles on all of this, and hopefully all of the craziness leading us to, you know, getting, you know, the decision made on what candidates we're going to be voting for in November, maybe once this calms down a little bit, will all of this, does all of this lead to more people turning out for the election, or is this going to turn voters off? I mean, this is going to be an election that is all about turnout, and I'm wondering, does all of this messiness that we've seen and all of this craziness in this election, does it do more to bring attention, or does it simply turn voters off?
No, I think it will energize voters. I think you see certainly the energizing on the Democratic side, the money, the support that has flowed to Kamala Harris really within 48 hours. It's quite amazing. Mm-hmm. Democrats think they've gotten a new life and that they're going to run a competitive contest. Also importantly is the down ballot candidates, Senate and House. Democrats believe that Kamala Harris at the top of the ticket will actually enhance their chances, you know, in their own individual races in local and state elections. And of course, the Republicans had a very successful convention. They were energized at that convention, and so they're raring to go. They rolled out what they consider to be a successful ticket and a successful convention. So the Republicans are energized, and now the Democrats are newly energized. So I think the effects of the last week or so, 2 weeks, is really going to help spur turnout. So I do believe it'll be a relatively good turnout. I mean, you can never say high because you never know, but I think it will be a relatively good turnout election because both parties, I think, now have cause to be energized about the top of the ticket and then, of course, about the down races as well.
Again, we'll see what happens next. Certainly, Democrats have answered one of the major questions that they had going into this race, but also possibly have raised others in the process. So the next couple of months going to be very, very interesting to watch. Again, Professor Alan Sanders with us this morning, former Time Magazine senior reporter, Professor Emeritus of Political Science, St. Peter's University, Jersey City, New Jersey. Professor Sanders, thanks as always. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Chris. Take care.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM. We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
You think politics in this country is crazy? Check this out. In the Philippines, the mayor of a town in the Philippines has gone into hiding after being accused of being a Chinese spy. Wow. Police have a warrant for her arrest, but have so far been unable to take her into custody as she was not found at any of her residences. The story goes back to March when scam centers linked to China were discovered in her town. The centers used online casinos as a cover for illegal activity. And apparently they then linked, I don't know if they have any evidence linking the mayor to just the fact that there were these scam centers in her town. But I guess the buck stops here, right? I guess it really stops there. They've issued a warrant for her arrest for being a Chinese spy. She posted on Facebook that she would be temporarily absent. after the warrant was issued for her arrest. The statement reads, quote, "Sorry for not being physically present with each one of you. I miss you all." All right. So if you think we have dysfunctional politics in this country, I guess it could always be worse. Wow. Elsewhere in the broken news, the odd and unusual side of the headlines, officials at the Detroit Zoo say two grizzly bears somehow got into a restricted area at the zoo, which is a little unusual. Normally, it's the people that are entering into restricted areas and having close encounters with animals. In this case, the bears made their way into an animal care area early on Saturday, and it was the animals that were getting into the restricted area. Officials say no one was injured and zoo visitors were never in danger. The staff at the zoo worked to quickly manage the situation following all safety protocols to keep both humans and the bears safe. The animals now back in their own habitat, and all is well with the world. The incident is under investigation. I wonder if the bears were looking to maybe take a selfie with some humans. All these stories about people taking selfies with bears, they really shouldn't be. Maybe it was the bears. Figured turnabout is fair play. I don't know. Elsewhere, because there always has to be a story out of Florida, Jose Farinango. I'm not sure where in Florida he's from. It just says he's a Florida man, Jose Farinango, being charged with fraudulently misrepresenting his homemade jewelry as Native American. Mr. Farinango allegedly presented his work in art shows across the country, but it does not appear to actually be Native American in any way, shape, or form. Safeguarding Native American culture, traditions, and the consumers who purchase authentic Native American art are a critical part of these investigations, according to Edward Grace of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Law Enforcement. If convicted, he faces up to 25 years in prison. 25 years. So if you're thinking of passing off some of the some handmade jewelry as Native American, no. I don't know. Maybe you figured, hey, I was born here. I'm a Native American. Doesn't work that way. Doesn't really work that way. Have a 4th of July follow-up story here in the broken news. This out of Tacoma, Washington, where a human finger has finally been returned to its owner. After the digit was found on July 5th, officials believe it had perhaps been the result of a fireworks accident. Now, it should be noted, local hospitals did not have any record of any such injury happening on the 4th of July, but it does seem like that would be the logical conclusion, given that the digit was found on July 5th. The owner of the finger apparently saw the story about the about its recovery on the local news and came forward to claim his body part. Can you imagine? Hey, they found a finger. I lost a finger. I wonder if that could be the same one. How do you come forward to claim that it's, hey, I lost that? Well, can you identify that finger? While the man wanted to remain anonymous, he has reportedly said that he did, in fact, injure himself with fireworks. It does not appear any charges will be filed at this time. So. I don't want to point any fingers, but perhaps he's suffered enough, including the indignity of having to come forward and try and claim your missing finger. You know? All right. And finally, in the broken news this morning, and this is actually a really sweet story, a Texas family discovered a small bird, an abandoned orphaned baby bird, this past Saturday while barbecuing. Noticed that the animal appeared to be cold and in distress. in distress. So the mom of the family, you know, so the family's barbecuing and they see this this bird on the ground. It definitely is in trouble. It is cold, and baby birds obviously don't want it to be cold. So mom throws a tortilla on the grill and uses it as a burrito blanket, as she put it. Undoubtedly, it was an inventive method to keep the baby bird warm, and surprisingly, it was very effective, according to the local Wild West Wildlife Rehabilitation Center. So they wrapped the baby bird in the tortilla and then took it to the wildlife rehab center, and the baby bird is going to be just fine. Turns out it was a Mississippi kite, which is a bird native to Texas, and it is now recovering. They have named the bird Taquito. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report. Update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
WFIN needs your help to stuff the bus with school supplies for needy students in our area. Go to WFIN.com for donation information. Bring your donation to the Yellow School Bus at the Tiffin Avenue McDonald's in Findlay Thursday and Friday, July 25th and 26th from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. and Saturday, July 27th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. School supply registration forms are required and can be accessed at cchsupport.org. Stuff the Bus, brought to you by McDonald's and 1330 WFIN.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. Be honest now, have you ever gone out in public, gone to work, something like that, when you were sick and probably shouldn't have? New research study out of the University of Michigan finds, and this is really interesting, people are actually more likely to conceal their sicknesses when their risk of infecting others is higher. The higher your risk of infecting others, the more likely you are to conceal it. This should not be the case. Those are complete opposite. 4,000 plus participants in this study, 75% said that they have hidden having an infectious illness or admitted that they would do so in the future. And those in the survey admit that they have socialized while they were sick. They have boarded a plane when they were sick and shouldn't have. They've even gone on dates and maybe infected a date while they were sick. 61% of those working in the healthcare industry said that they had hidden an infectious illness, which is a bit disturbing. The lead author of the study, Wilson Merrill, says actively sick people reported high levels of concealment regardless of how harmful their illness was to others. People, they theorize, may hide their sickness to avoid being perceived as weak or lazy or to avoid isolation. I thought this was something that we figured out during COVID, that when we're sick, we need to stay away from other people. We don't want to spread illness, infect others. But apparently, it is a lesson we either haven't learned or have very quickly forgotten. So, happening around town, there is another big celebration happening this weekend at the Black Heritage Library and Multicultural Center. Joining us with a preview, their Haitian Caribbean Summer Festival. First of all, Jerome Gray from the Black Heritage Library, Multicultural Center. Always a pleasure, sir. Thanks very much for dropping by. So, first of all, give us the basic details here on the festival.
Okay, this celebration is a family-friendly, community-wide celebration, offering live music with two bands and some other local entertainers, as well as local vendors, food trucks, and with should be a lot of fun and games for all.
And that is happening on Saturday, right?
Saturday, July 27th, and the time is of the celebration is from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m.
Okay. Also with us in the studio, and I want to make sure that I get this right, Hashmi Devriel, is that right?
Gabriel.
Gabriel, okay. And I apologize for that. You actually, the first Haitian national in come to Findlay, right? To take up residence here.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
So talk a little bit about your story, how you ended up in Findlay, Ohio, USA.
It's, I would say, like, first of all, I want to thank you for hosting us, and good to be here.
Absolutely.
Like, I grew up in Haiti, and my experience in Haiti as a translator working in Mission Possible. Mission Possible is non-profit organization that working in Haiti, helping children. And my job translation, I have many friends in Haiti, meet with them there. When I travel, coming to live in USA with my family, they live in Florida.
Okay.
And then instead of staying with my family in Florida, I feel there's not a big family to come here and spend time with. And this is how I come in Findlay.
And so what has that transition been like to come to our community versus everything else that you've experienced along that journey?
First of all, I want to say, like, it was challenging because coming from Haiti as a weather, the weather difference and leave Florida, coming in Ohio, especially in winter, it was really challenging. Yes. But I can tell you, because of those support I had, I didn't really feel too much challenging because I go through it really smooth with my family. And right now, living with my wife, we have two kids. And I can tell you, it was challenging at first, but right now, it took a while before I adjusted. But
how significant is this to have this type of festival here, the Haitian Caribbean Summer Festival, to share that culture and maybe introduce it to many people, I'm sure, that are unfamiliar?
Yes, I think it's really important. One of the reasons, because, you know, we have two different culture, and everyone can learn each one from one another. And the Asian will learn from the American culture, and the American culture will learn from the Asian culture. We have a variety of food that some American who have the opportunity to travel to Haiti, they are able to taste that type of flavor.
Yeah.
But coming here, it will be an opportunity for all the American and anyone else who want to explore this culture better. I think this is the good time for them to do that.
Chris. We talk about how we strive to be a welcoming community. This is such an important part of that.
Yeah, as part of You Belong, that whole campaign. But this event is designed for all of Findlay and Hancock County. It's to promote human interaction among the residents. The event is needed due to the growth of the Haitian and Caribbean community here in Findlay. And the desired intent is to promote conversation that will hopefully lead to unity and harmony among people of different races, cultural heritage, and ethnic backgrounds.
I reminded Hashmi, as I heard you talking about you know, blending those cultures, I'm reminded of, there's a country song about how, if you look at the average American Saturday night, we have Mexican food and we drink, you know, our Coronas, and, you know, we have a French kiss under the moonlight with our friends. It's a country song. We do tend to bring the best of all of our cultures into what is the American experience.
That is America, Chris.
Yeah, yeah. We have pizzas on the
front end. It's a
blend. Yeah.
Yeah.
And but this is an interesting subset of that that we don't often talk about.
Well, this is a recent addition.
Yeah.
You know, our heritage are made up of different backgrounds, different ethnicities, and we bring all those and we bring that food. Mm-hmm. This is one of the latest additions to the fabric of America.
And you got to have food.
Got to have food.
Got to have food. Got to have food.
If you allow me, I'd be remiss not to mention our sponsors.
Yes.
This event is being sponsored by the Finley Hancock Community Foundation as part of their Fun for All series of free community activity.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have funding from the Blanchard Valley Health System and from Michael's Arts and Crafts Store.
Yeah. So, again, it is happening on Saturday and, again, from 2 to 8 at the library on
817 Harmon Street,
yeah.
Finley, Ohio.
The idea of giving everybody the opportunity to experience the culture and maybe learn a little something. What is the biggest question that you often get asked, Hashmi, when people inquire about your culture?
Yes, there are many questions. Yeah. I would say sometimes they say, what about the language? Is it like French, or is it the Creole? Is it different?
Mm-hmm.
I always have this question, and also there are many questions I always get.
This is an opportunity for people to ask those questions, the things that you wonder about, because most of us will never travel to that region of the world, so it's an opportunity to learn. More, and that's really, again,
and that's why we're hosting it.
And what it's all about.
Everyone will come out. Mm-hmm. Fun for family. It's a family-friendly event. Children are welcome. We'll have bouncy house. We've got games for the kids. We'll have our free snow cones and popcorn as we normally do at all of our events.
Yeah.
And there'll be plenty of food from the food trucks and the vendors.
Absolutely. Yeah.
One, like the game for the kids, it's a game the kids play in 80.
Okay.
And this game, they always play it on the ground. So
okay.
I put it on the table. I reinvent the name. I call it Zikos Table.
Okay.
It's called. This is a game that even though the kids, they don't know, but when these kids see I have some maples, the other has some maples, they get together. And they play together.
How cool is that to be able to share some of that with, again, kids that otherwise would never be exposed to that? That's just really cool.
Yeah. Yes, it's always good to explore new things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those will help to attach
the
bridge.
Especially with the kids.
Yep. Yes.
Especially with the kids. We've got a link up for more information about the Haitian Caribbean Summer Festival coming up on Saturday at the Black Heritage Library and Multicultural Center. Hashmi, Jerome, thanks very much for dropping by. We certainly appreciate it. Look forward to a great event.
Thank you.
And with that, we will put the wraps on another edition of the podcast. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. And remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. That is goodmornings.net. So check us out online. And coming up tomorrow morning on the program, we're talking about preparing kids for back to school. But it's not just about getting fresh number two pencils and new clothes. It also means equipping them to deal with the bullies who will also be headed back to class as well. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow. We'll